You're listening to the weekly teaching podcast of Willamette Christian Church in Westland, Oregon. We hope that what you hear today inspires you to laugh, question, think, and grow. If you'd like to connect with us even further, hit us up online at willamette.cc or shoot us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this week's episode.
I am so happy that you are all here. This is going to be a great morning. Great morning. 3 weeks into this series. Oh, before we get started, I want to say hey to everybody who's watching online and doing online interaction, because like a couple weeks ago, I went to online church. I was like, online church, that's not a thing. That's just watching TV and calling it church. But then they started asking me questions, and I started answering back. And it was actually more interactive than this, because if you ask me a question, I'm not going to answer it. So hey to Pastor Phil and everybody doing online church. Super sweet. Oh, so this series is all about people. When you have a close encounter with God, it closes that gap between where God is and where we are. Like, each and every one of us is in this spot where, like, we're who we are, but God has got this greatness that he wants us to be, where he is living his kingdom life. And how that gap gets closed is Jesus, that God himself came, lived in fashion as a person, giving his life for us so that we could be united to him. And so a close encounter with God always gives us those things that we want, but we can't get without him. And so today we're going to look at a story in the Bible where somebody has a close encounter with God and it totally changes them, right? It helps them discover who they truly are, and it infuses them with hope for their future. Before we do that, though, I want to tell you a little bit of something I'm very excited about. 4th of July is coming up, right? You guys are excited? Nobody is excited about the 4th of July. If you can't get excited about the 4th of July, something's gone horribly wrong in your life. 4th of July is coming up, and that means outdoor barbecues, picnics, Stranger Things, all the kind of things you love for the summer. Thank you. And in this, right, like, I have to tell you, one of my favorite things about the picnic is the Coke. I love Coca-Cola. When I was a kid, I drank so much Coca-Cola. To this day, I can still tell the difference between Coke and Pepsi just by smelling it. Yes, there are some Coke people in the room. If you're a Pepsi person, this next minute will just not be that interesting to you. I apologize in advance. Pepsi is very good as well. But for me and my money, it's Coke is it. So they didn't pay me to say that. So all my life, I drank Coke. I thought Coke was amazing. To this day, like when I travel, I'll pick up a Coke like wherever I am. So like when we went to Israel on a trip with the folks from the church, I grabbed myself a Hebrew Coke. Right? Coke, written in Hebrew. I was like, that's really cool. So I got it, I put it on a shelf at home. When we were in Jordan, I picked up a Coke written in Arabic. Right? Sorry. Arabic. It goes the other way. But that's not my favorite. Like, my favorite, I brought Coke across state lines. I purchased an eBay Coke. You want to see what it is? Some of you will remember this, and some of you are like, no. I have no idea what we're talking about. This is what I got, right? I bought a new Coke. Oh, did anybody here remember new Coke? Raise your hand if you remember new Coke. Yeah, new Coke, 1985. Coke decided they were going to promise us that they had changed the game and give us a new formula of Coca-Cola. That's right. They changed Coke from what it was to what it became. Like, decades of Coca-Cola gone in an instant and a new flavor. And you know how everybody thought about it, right? Well, most of you have never heard of it. Yeah, created quite a problem. Let me tell you what happened, right? Coke fell prey to something. You see, Pepsi, Coke's biggest competitor, launched a brilliant bit of strategy. Pepsi's a little bit sweeter than Coke, which means children will prefer the taste of Pepsi to Coca-Cola. So Pepsi launched something called the Pepsi Challenge. Did anyone here ever take the Pepsi Challenge? In the summer at the supermarket, a rep from Pepsi would show up. They would set up a display that invites you in. They'd give you a button that said, I took the Pepsi Challenge. And here's what would happen. They'd give you two cups, two little Dixie cups, one with Coke, one with Pepsi. People would choose the one they liked best. It's the summer. Mom and the children are in the store together. Teenagers are running wild in the streets. People are choosing Pepsi 2-1 because people are out. Children are out 2-1. But Pepsi already knows this. That's why they've hired Michael Jackson to sell Pepsi as the choice of the new generation. And suddenly Coke is living in fear. Because all of these young people are going to grow up, and all the people who like Coke are going to die, and we're going to be out of business. And in that moment, Coke changed its formula. Guess what new Coke tasted like? Pepsi. If you remember, yeah. And everybody who liked Coke lost their minds because they didn't want more Pepsi. They just wanted Coke. See, Coke fell for something. They fell for this. Letting somebody else tell you who you're supposed to be. Well, you're not Pepsi, so you're not good enough. And Coke believed it. See, in life, you have a choice to make about your identity. Are you going to be who you truly are, or are you going to be who people tell you they want you to be? You know, being who everyone tells you you need to be just leads to a tremendous amount of pain in your own life. It's not sustainable. It's not possible. But there's another problem, right? There's a problem of deciding who you're going to be and going out and being that person. Can I tell you what I love about Oreos, since we're on the subject? It's maybe the simplest, greatest thing there is. It's just chocolate and vanilla cream. That's it. And yet the only thing you can do to make an Oreo better is put it in milk. Chocolate and vanilla cream. But sometimes you're so convinced that you've got it figured out and you know exactly what's going on and you feel so strongly about your identity and how great your brand is that you can do whatever you want and other people are just going to have to adjust to it. I bring you watermelon Oreos. Yeah, this is exactly how America felt when they were issued and why most of you never heard about them. Because the two things that it takes to make a great cookie, chocolate and vanilla cream, they're gone. And when was the last time you were just at a backyard barbecue having a nice cold slice of watermelon and thought to yourself, you know what would make this better? Just dipping this in milk. Yeah. You can't even make it better. That's as bad as it gets. Now, here's the deal, right? In each of these situations, saying, no, I am who I am and you're going to like it no matter what I do, and I'll do whatever you want me to do just like me. The problem with letting other people set your identity or picking one and ramming it down everybody's throat is that in both situations, you're caught in a choice between pleasing yourself and making everybody else miserable or pleasing everybody else and making yourself miserable. Because our identity is largely this composite of how we feel about ourselves and how other people see or don't see us. And when this is what's going on in our life, people either set the terms of our life for us or we try to set the terms of everyone else's life for them. But there is a third way. And if you have your Bibles, open with me to the book of Genesis, and we're going to look at the story of somebody who made a huge public failure. Genesis chapter 32. Huge public failures are difficult, right? Because people spent millions of dollars trying to market watermelon Oreos and New Coke. People lost jobs. People lost reputations. And when you blow it really bad, you've got two choices, right? You can either run, go to a new place and try to start all over again, or you can try to do some other great thing that you hope will distract from the bad things that you've done. And these are the choices we're caught between. In this story, we're going to find somebody who thought they could run, try to stay one step ahead of the bread line, one swing ahead of the sword. It's a story about someone who stole only what they couldn't afford. And that was everything. Who is this riffraff, street rat, scoundrel? It's not Aladdin, because that's not a Bible story. It's the story of Jacob, right? Here's what you need to know about the story of Jacob. Jacob is the grandson of a man named Abraham. God shows up in the book of Genesis and he promises Abraham three things. He says, I'm going to give you a land, a place to live. I'm going to give you a family. And out of that family, I'm going to give you a blessing that goes from you to the whole world. As you read the story of the Bible from start to finish, you discover that that land becomes the land of Israel, and those people become the Jewish people, and that blessing is Jesus, who comes to earth to close the gap between where we are and where God wants us to be. Jacob is the second grandson born to Abraham. He's a twin. He's a fraternal twin, and they didn't really know he was coming. It's a little bit like the magic handkerchief trick. The mom is pregnant, and the baby starts to come out, and they get the baby, and lo and behold, attached to the one baby is another baby holding on to the other baby, and it's like, we got babies coming out. The first baby, they name him Esau. He's like made out of muscle. He'd play linebacker. He's just tough. And every last inch of him's covered with hair. The second baby, the one holding on to the leg of the first baby, they name him Jacob. And you know why they named him Jacob? Because when they looked at him, this is how they saw him. He's holding on to his brother. He's trying to usurp him. He'd rather get out first. He wants the position of primacy in the family. This is why it was so important. Because whoever was the oldest son in the family, it was the custom that this was the man who would replace the father when the father died. He'd receive 2/3 of the father's wealth because it was going to be his job to provide for everyone else. And everyone else in the family answered to him. He became the new patriarch. And so Esau and his brother Jacob are born into this situation, and Jacob was just seconds behind receiving the right of the firstborn. Now, to demonstrate how they saw Jacob, how they thought about Jacob, the identity they had for him, they gave him the name Jacob, which means deceiver. Apologies to any of you named Jacob. Your parents clearly didn't do the research. Go by Jake. Into this situation, right? Esau grows up to be this skillful hunter warrior. Everyone looks up to him. Everyone sees him as the future of the family. But Jacob is, the Bible calls him a smooth man, right? He's not as hairy as his brother, but he's also a smooth operator when it comes to using his words. And if you get around Jacob, who prefers to spend his time around the tents, you better watch out because he's going to talk you into what he wants. And what he wants most of all is he wants to be the leader, because nobody wants a life where everyone tells you you're number two and you're just going to have to follow along and hope it works out for you. Beyond this, he actually believes he's smarter than Esau and more deserving, and he creates his own Pepsi challenge to prove it. See, Esau goes off to go hunting, and Jacob makes a huge pot of red stew. And as he's making the pot of red stew, he's just waiting for his brother to come home. And when his brother comes home and he didn't catch any animals, his brother's like, "I'm famished, I'm starving, give me some of that stew." And Jacob goes, "Oh, you can have it, but you're gonna have to give me the right of the firstborn." And his brother goes, "Well, what good is the right of the firstborn going to be to me if I'm dead? So sure, trade, deal." Jacob throws in some bread as well. Now, in this moment, he demonstrated that not only was he smarter, but that he wanted it more. But this isn't a legally binding agreement that's going to hold up in probate court after dad is dead. So he's still got some work to do to get what he truly wants. And so after a few years, the Bible says that their father is dying. He's laying in his tent and he's on his deathbed, and he asks for Esau to go out and to catch him some wild game and prepare it, because that's his favorite thing. Before he dies, he wants to have a last meal. And then he's going to call Esau in. He's going to give him a prophetic blessing to speak words of truth over his life and set his destiny, and then give him the family heirlooms. So Esau goes out to get the animal, and that's when Jacob's mom, who always liked Jacob best, hatches a scheme. She brings Jacob in and she says, "I want you to put on your brother's clothes. We're going to make you smell like your brother. We're going to get some animal hair. We're going to put it on your skin and your face so that when you go in and present the food we're going to make him, he thinks you're Esau, and he's going to bless you, and then you will receive what it is you've always wanted." And so they do it. And the father is in the tent in the dark, and he says, "The voice sounds like Jacob, but it looks and it smells and it feels like Esau." And so he blesses him. He gives him the staff and the documents and the family seal. And Jacob has now finally gotten everything that he wanted: his father's blessing and the tokens to rule the family. Here's the problem, though, is that his brother's coming home. And anytime we take something before we're supposed to have it, or we take things we're not supposed to have, we may get our hands on it, but we don't ever get to keep and enjoy it. Because when Esau gets home, there's going to be a reckoning for what Jacob has done. So Jacob runs, and he spends the next 20 years of his life running from Esau. And this becomes Jacob's MO. Do what you got to do, but just stay one step ahead. You don't want your past to catch up with you. And wherever you go, keep reinventing yourself. The difficulty with this, though, is that Jacob is actually a liar, a cheat. He is the deceiver. And no matter where he goes, he brings himself along with him. And not only that, he keeps running into the exact same kind of people. And the Bible tells us that he meets his match in a man named Laban. Laban is a landowner, and Jacob just wants to settle down. He wants to build a family. He wants to have animals and accumulate wealth. He wants to get and get and get. So Laban gives him a job, and he begins to work for Laban. But then Laban has something else that Jacob wants. Laban has two daughters, and the youngest daughter is beautiful. And Jacob says, I'm in love with her, and I want to marry her. And Laban says, well, it's customary in our people that you will pay a bride price. If I'm going to lose this special thing to me, you have to pay me. So if you work for me for 7 years, then you can have my daughter in marriage. And so the Bible says that Jacob works for 7 years, and because he loves this woman so much that the time passes that fast. When it comes time for the marriage, Laban suddenly has a problem. You see, it's also customary in Laban's land that the children are married off by birth order as well. And no one in the last 7 years has spoken up for the oldest daughter. So Laban does something. And tell me if this sounds familiar. What he does is he takes the older daughter and he dresses her in the younger daughter's clothes. And at the wedding ceremony, with the veil on, he slips her into the ceremony. And the next morning, Jacob wakes up married to somebody else. And that's when Laban makes him an offer he can't refuse. And it's not a buy one, get one. If you want to work another 7 years, I'll let you have the daughter that you wanted. And what this does is it produces now a family of misery, because now there are two women vying for one man's affection and resentment all around to the father for what he's done. And soon Jacob and Laban cannot trust each other. They can't work together. They can't live together. They're constantly double-crossing each other. So Jacob just takes everything and he runs. The problem is there's no place left to go but home. And as he approaches the family's homestead, there's a river called the River Jabbok. As he gets to the River Jabbok, word comes to reach him that Esau knows you're coming, and he's coming out to meet you with 400 men. And that's when Jacob realizes that to come home, he has to confront everything he's run from. In Genesis chapter 32, starting in verse 22, we're going to read about this encounter that Jacob has. God is truly doing something in Jacob's life, with Jacob's life, for Jacob's life. But Jacob's got to become transformed if he's going to be different. If what he's going to do is going to be different than what he's always done, then something new is going to have to take place within him. And so in Genesis chapter 32, verse 22, it says this. That night, Jacob got up and he took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and he crossed the ford, that's the crossing of the river, of the Jabbok. And after he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all of his possessions. You see, Jacob knows that this isn't going to be a welcoming party coming to see him. So he takes his children and his wives and all of his possessions, and he puts them on the far side of the river. But he himself stays back. And the real question is now, will Jacob do what Jacob has always done? Will he split? And in the midst of this evening, by the river, by the fire, he has an encounter that changes his life. So Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. And the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Should have noticed this, that Jacob was strong enough that he could wrestle with this guy. He was strong enough and he was a good enough wrestler that he could wrestle all night, and this person could not overpower him. As the sun starts to come up, Jake the snake is about to prevail. And that's when, first service didn't get that. That's when the man he's wrestling with realizes, I'm not going to overpower Jacob, but I'm not going to wrestle with him forever. And so he touches him on the hip and it dislocates his hip from the socket. And Jacob in this moment knows he can't wrestle to win now. He can only wrestle to not lose. And what he decides to do in this moment is just cling on with all of his strength to this man. And finally, this man says, hey, let me go. Get off of me. It's daybreak. I want to leave. And Jacob says, I'm not going to let go of you until you pronounce a blessing over me. This is different behavior from Jacob. See, Jacob would typically run, or Jacob would typically make some great big accomplishment to prove that he was bigger than his past. But in this moment, he can't run. So all he can do is cling. And in clinging, asks for this blessing. Now, he said that a close encounter with God will transform you. And here's a big spoiler alert. This man that he's wrestling with is truly God. And we'll see as the clues unfold that Jacob has been wrestling with people for his identity, but now he's wrestling with God for his identity. Then the man asked him, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. Jacob responded with his identity. I'm Jacob, the deceiver. And the man that he was wrestling said, you will no longer be known as this. What you have done will no longer be the definition of who you are. I am going to give you a new name, Israel. It means wrestles with God. Have you ever considered that following Jesus is going to be like a wrestling and grappling match, that is going to be a struggle and a fight for your very existence? When God calls you to follow him, when he calls you to leave behind what it is you were previously doing and run and turn to chase him, that you're going to have to let go of some things, and you're going to wrestle with yourself and your desires, and you're going to wrestle with what everybody else wants for you, but that you need to surrender and accept what God has for you. In this moment, God is saying you'll no longer be known by what you have done in the past, but by who you will be in the future. You've wrestled with God and you've wrestled with man and you have overcome. You have turned from what you used to do. And by clinging to me, you have achieved what you never would have accomplished in the past. See, our identity, it's truly found in how God sees us, not in how others see us or how we see ourselves. And we can live our life trying to please other people or living to please ourselves. But in each of those situations, we're basically selling out the other group of people. But in living how God sees us and living to please him, in turning away from what we had and turning to him, we actually can please God and trust that God will give us joy and peace and happiness, a new identity and a fresh start at the future. You see, what Jacob longed for most of all was that blessing, that word of prophecy spoken over him. And when he goes to God for that and God gives it to him, it transforms and it shapes and it changes him into who God wants him to be, not who he used to be. Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he, the man, replied, why do you ask my name? Like if you don't know me by now, Jacob. Then he blessed him there. And so Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, it is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. Jacob, in the presence of God, got to see who he was and who God was, and that he shouldn't have lived through the experience. I've seen God face to face and lived. And that in our encounters with God, in our striving with God, when we cling to him, when we grip onto him, when we tell him we care about his blessing more than anybody else's, when we pursue him and what he says about us, that's when we find that transformed life. And it transforms and shapes us and changes us in ways that we can't possibly imagine, but in ways that we desperately need. Verse 31 says this, the sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. That's weird. A lot of times you're reading stuff in the Bible and you're like, I don't know why that's there. Just act normal and walk away. You know, sometimes you're reading the book and you can't pronounce a guy's name. starts with an S, so his name is Sam now for the rest of the... We do that with the Bible, right? We get to a part we don't understand, so we just keep reading. What if this weird culinary bit is included in the Bible for a very specific reason? See, Israel, Jacob, becomes the father of all of the Israelites. Those sons that they mentioned in the passage, these become the tribes of Israel. And at the date this was written, the author is saying, hey, we want you to know that all of the children, the sons, the family, if you're having dinner with the Hebrews, they're not going to eat this specific portion of the animal out of respect for when God touched their father and changed him. They're honoring the legacy that when God touched Jacob, he changed him. He set him apart. He reserved him for his purposes. He changed him from who he was into who he was supposed to be, that there was a godly future and a righteous destiny for Jacob as Israel. You know, sometimes you're like driving in the car and it's like pouring down like Oregon torrential rain like it was a few days ago. And you're like at Target and you're looking for a place to park and you think you finally found one, but you pull in and there's that blue sign. There's a reserve for disabled parking. And you're like, never mind the fact that a disabled person should be parking there so that you can get in. You know what I mean? That sign, that reserved, set apart, special, unique, only for this purpose. Don't use this if you are not this. That's what the term holiness means. That whatever God touches, God makes holy. He doesn't just make it his. He makes it his for a purpose. He turns it into an instrument to accomplish his will. And so when he touches Jacob's hip, he reserves Jacob for himself. And so the people of Israel are saying, in the way that God touched our father and made him holy, which made us a holy nation, we are not going to touch this and demonstrate that it is set apart as well. And so it's there to help us understand that when God transforms us and gives us that new identity and that hope for the future, it's to serve his purposes, not our own. So if you're looking for that fresh start, know that he's calling you into a fresh start with a fresh identity to accomplish his will, not to set you back to where you came from. Genesis 33, verse 3, we get to see these changes that have been made. Jacob takes a huge group of servants and animals and sends them ahead of the family to meet his brother as a gift. And then instead of staying at the back and hiding, he moves out to the front. It says this, he himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. See, God removed Jacob's ability to run, but then he pointed him towards his brother and sent him as a changed person to meet him. And previously, Jacob thought he was smarter and thought he was better, but now he's demonstrating in front of his whole family and in front of his own brother that he is humble, that he is living the way God has called him to live. And he doesn't see himself as better, smarter, faster, stronger. Esau asked, what is the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met? To find favor in your eyes, my Lord, he said. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. No, please, said Jacob, if I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me favorably. He sees God's hand in saving him and restoring him to his brother. Please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted. He's been transformed from deceitful and greedy to honest and generous. He's living out that humility. A humble person is always seeking the best of those around them, not giving in to them to receive something, but seeking the best for them. Remember that skill that Jacob had for being a smooth operator, talking his way in and out of situations? He's now using that very gift, not to get what he wants, but to talk his brother into taking what is best for him. Don't miss this. When God transforms your life, when he touches you, when he makes you holy, when he sends you out to be his instrument, he's going to use all those gifts he gave you, but he's going to use them to accomplish his will, not for you to get what you want. You will be somebody who sharpens and shapes other people. You will be somebody who encourages, who gives, who serves, who loves in new ways. That when the kingdom of God comes in your life, it spreads from you to others. That's why he redeems us, because he's spreading himself in us, to us, through us. Just going to skip to verse 19 and 20 here, because I want to see you to see how this section ends for Jacob. For 100 pieces of silver, he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. And there he set up an altar and he called it El Elohe Israel. But that thing that he always wanted, to have a place to settle down, to not have to run, to enjoy what God had given him, he finally got, and he got it honestly. You see, a fresh start, it comes from clinging to God, not in running from our past. When we cling to God, God takes us, he shapes us, he transforms us, and then he sends us where he wants us to go, and it's in doing his will that we find ourselves with the hope we had for the future. Jacob and his family eventually become the people of Israel, and Jesus is born, and Jesus lives, and he dies and brings peace to us today because Jacob stopped running, and he turned, and he waited for God to appear, and when God appeared, he clung on to him, and he did not leave until he got God's blessing. And the question is, do you want that? Because if you do, then you've got to stop running, and you've got to wait for God to show up. So often when we blow it, we've got our own version of running. The things that we do to try to stay one step ahead of the problem, the thing that we did, the thing we don't want people to know. For me, it starts with being in denial. I act like it never happened. I treat people like, oh, they don't know. It doesn't work, because the only person we're ever really fooling is ourselves. So from denial, I moved to minimization. Well, yeah, there is a problem, but it's not really that bad. If you think about it, it's not that bad. I mean, it could have been worse. I mean, I did this, but I didn't do this. Try to manage that situation. That only works for so long, because the problem keeps getting worse when we don't address it. It begins to spread and people begin to see it. So that's when I stop trying to minimize it. So when I start trying to distract people, well, yeah, I did that, but I mean, there's way worse things out there that other people are doing. You ever get pulled over for a ticket and appeal to bank robbery? Now, I'm sure this is the most important thing you could be doing today. All the bank robbers and kidnappers out there, you got to give me this ticket. Meanwhile, he's thinking, yeah, I didn't even want to do this today. There's bank robbers and kidnappers out there, and I got to deal with you. That doesn't work. You got to move on to deflection. That's where you own it, but you push it right back on somebody else. Well, if I am angry, it's your fault. These are the ways we run. We try to stay a step ahead of it so that we can try to do some other great thing to distract people so that they see the good things we did and they think of us differently now. But when we do that, we're not saying, God, I need you to show up in this situation. I'm going to own what has happened. This is what I did. This is who I am. I've got to get from here to here. And I'm counting on God to show up and change me. So I'm sorry. I want to be this. This is where I am. Living in honesty. Stop running and wait for God to show up, because he will. And when he does show up, you grip onto him and you don't let go, no matter how bad it hurts, no matter how far away he seems, no matter how far away you seem. I talk to people all the time who say, you don't know how far I've run from God. That's the crazy part. It's like he's always here, no matter how far you run. So all it takes is that turn and he's there. And ultimately, you're going to be as far away from God as you want to be. Because he doesn't go anyplace. He's waiting for you to turn and come home. And it's just one step of saying, hey, the running, the hiding, it's not worth it. And to grip onto him means to spend time with him, to let him speak to you, to hear his voice. I'm shocked at the number of Christians who think that you can just be a Christian by agreeing with what something said at some point in time, and then you just keep doing your thing. It's like, no, being a Christian is knowing Christ. It's getting to know the Jesus who saved you. And that happens by spending time together, listening, talking with other believers, encouraging one another, spurring each other on to love and good deeds. And you just have to set your heart to do it, pick a plan, and then act on it. That's what it takes. This is how easy it is, right? I'm going to talk to both smart people and cool people right here. Smart people, you have an Android phone. Cool people, you have an iPhone. You can just go to the App Store. They have them for each of your phones, right? You go to the App Store, you just type in YouVersion. It's the Bible app. It's free. You just tap on that. You can do it right now. You download it for free here. When you open it up, you just click on that little magnifying glass to the search bar. Type in identity. It'll bring up three verses right away that you can read. Or like down at the bottom, see it says plans. You click on the Living Changed Identity one. Tap start plan. Your phone will buzz in the morning and tell you, hey, read these passages. Pray these prayers. You just have to want time with God, set an intention for time with God and do it, and you will have close encounters with him, and he will tell you who you are, how he sees you, and how he sees you and who you are is more important than how everybody else sees you and who you're trying to be. And when you live into that, when you hear him say, you're my child, you are my beloved, I gave my life for you. Then you start recognizing that your self-worth isn't based on what you can do or what you can do for other people. It's based on what he has done for you. That everybody in this room cost the same thing, which was the life of Jesus. You want to live like you're worth the life of the Son of God. Because ultimately, God believes in your ability to be righteous so much that he sent Jesus to die for you. And Satan believes in your ability to be righteous so much that he's trying to trip you up, going around like a roaring lion, trying to devour you. So the only person who doesn't believe it is because you don't live the identity he has spoken over you. And lastly, beg for his blessing. And this simply means care more about what he says about you than what other people say. Because other people have a plan for your life that's not good for you. And the plan you come up on your own for yourself, it's not going to be good for them. But if you beg for his blessing, that how he sees you and the truth he speaks over you, the prophecies he makes about you, the power he sends you out in, that's the most important thing. A few years ago, I met a woman named Chrissy. Chrissy's at our Hope City campus. She serves regularly. She told us her story, and it was one of these like, I couldn't ever have imagined this was true about you. Because there was a past identity, and then there is her in Jesus identity. When she told us the story, we asked, can we share this with everybody? And she said, absolutely. And so this is Chrissy's story, and I want you to listen to how Chrissy describes the concepts of identity and future and hope and fresh starts.